Good morning and welcome to the August, the September 9th edition of Mountain Money. I want to follow up on a traffic report Leslie gave coming in from Camas this morning. There is one lane closed on 248 as you approach 40. It's created a really substantial backup. Once you clear the stoplight at 40, things are pretty open all the way into Park City. Today on Mountain Money, we've got a really interesting show. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. How are you?
We're going to start by talking to author Evan Friss. He's got an interesting new book called The Bookshop, A History of the American Bookstore.
And then we have Adam and Misha Ross. They'll share with us the ins and outs of their new restaurant, Loma. And at the end of the hour, we'll be with Gord Boyce of Mayflower Mountain Partners, who will explain what EOS is and why you may want it.
All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Well, there's something unique about people who choose to go into the business of selling books. For many, it is really part job and part love story. In his new book, The Bookshop, A History of the American Bookstore, author Evan Friss takes us on a tour of the American bookstore landscape from the pre-revolutionary era to today. It's a book filled with fascinating characters. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Evan, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So, Evan, what drew you to this topic, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, I was living in New York City, studying American history in graduate school, and my wife got a job at the local neighborhood bookshop in the West Village, a place called Three Lives and Company. And it was really through her experience that I came to appreciate the power and magic of bookstores. So I had always been a serious reader, and I was in, as I said, studying American history, which involved a great deal of reading. But I really wasn't the kind of person who hung around bookstores and was afraid to be a kind of regular. But she would come home and talk about her shift, and it was usually not so much about the books, but rather the people that made the space and the interesting characters. And I got to realize, for at least a subset of the population, how important a kind of daily or at least weekly or monthly stop at the local bookstore was. And as someone studying American history began to ask questions about how did this institution evolve, when were their first bookstores, and of course, why were they in decline?
Interesting. So one thing that I really loved about it, now Ben Franklin is known for many things, but his role as a bookseller is less widely known. Can you share a bit about that, please?
Sure. So up until his death, he liked to self-identify as a printer and bookseller, and this was a critical part of his life. And reflecting back on the Revolution, he and historians subsequently have realized how important educating the American public was, in this case, radicalizing them, often with literature from abroad, in terms of shaping the Revolution. So Franklin, before he really became a famous scientist and writer and then eventually diplomat, he was a printer, and he studied in London, opened up his own shop with a partner at first, and then he eventually left and came back, and there was a kind of rotating cast of characters with whom he worked. But he had this print shop, and at first it was really just a way to make money, but he got heavily invested in literature, printing, and sometimes writing his own political essays, of course his famous almanac, and it operated as this multifunctional space that was a post office. It was a place where people could pick up newspapers, but it was also a place where people came to get literature, important kinds of literature, at a time when it was very scarce and hard to get one's hands on books.
Interesting. So to unpack that a little bit more, so he had a bookshop with a print shop in the back?
It was all one space, so it certainly wasn't a kind of quiet, cozy bookstore like we might imagine today. There were loud, thundering presses, probably groans from men working them. There was kegs of ink sitting in the corner, and lots of kind of messiness abound, as well as lots of pamphlets and essays and books, and most of the books were much smaller then, and you know, oftentimes stitched together, so there weren't shelves of kind of hardback books like we would imagine, but it was a place where people came to buy school books, Psalms, his favorite kind of almanac, and also some classics, and eventually Shakespeare and such.
One of the themes of the book is that bookstores are what I call multivariate institutions. They do lots and lots of different things, or at least the ones that you discuss do. Let's talk a little bit about the Old Corner in Boston. It wasn't simply a place to go in and buy a book.
Yeah, so I call the Old Corner one of the first modern American bookstores, and it was also multifunctional, like Ben Franklin's shop, insofar as the people who ran it, these guys named Tickner and Fields, also had a publishing outfit. So they signed American authors, published and distributed from this bookstore. But as a retail space, what really made it modern was that there were books on the shelves, there were books on islands of tables, and it was really a community space. So lots of local writers as well as non-authors would come to the shop to really just hang out and talk about books and congregate, and they would sometimes spill over to the coffee shop next door and sort of volley back and forth. But he was a kind of site for people to not just buy books, but learn about books, talk about books, and really turned into a kind of community space and where people could browse individually. So many of the bookstores before this, the books were locked up in cupboards or behind essentially moats. But here is a space where people could pick up a book, hold it in their hands, and as Oliver Wendell Holmes liked to say, who was one of the regulars, taste a book.
And what era was, when did it open and how long did it remain open?
Yeah, so it was from the late 1820s, and that particular outfit stayed in the same location until the Civil War, and it was actually replaced by a series of other bookstores, some of whom adopted the same name, the Old Corner, but they were really different outfits. But from 1828 to the 1860s, the Old Corner Bookstore and the publishing arm really helped develop American literature as we know it. So Nathaniel Hawthorne used to hang out there, and he was also one of the authors published there, as well as Longfellow, and I mentioned Holmes and others. So it really was, again, in Franklin's era, most of the people were not reading American literature. There really wasn't much of the sort, but the Old Corner helped birth American poetry and American sort of fine writers as we came to know them.
So let's say I was an aspiring writer in Boston back in the late 1820s. How would I walk into the old bookstore and hand them a manuscript and say, let's go for this?
Well, that's exactly what Louisa May Alcott did. So she lived about a mile away and traipsed her way through who knows what to get to the bookstore, and found her way past the green curtain where the guy named James Fields, who was really the kind of intellectual heart of the publishing arm and the editor and the one everyone wanted to curry favor with. And she literally handed him a manuscript. And he famously, or I guess infamously, said something to the degree of, you know, stick to your teaching, Miss Alcott, you can't write. And he would later admit that he was very wrong about this and many other decisions. But, you know, one of the interesting things is how often everybody is wrong in the book business and publishing business, and it's very hard to predict success. So Fields often got it right, but with Alcott, He certainly erred.
The concept of traveling bookstores emerged in the early 20th century. This is something that I had never heard of until I read this book. Can you explain a little bit about what they were and what was Parnassus on Wheels?
So it actually started with a novel. So fiction bled into real life. And Christopher Morley, who I didn't know much about until I started researching this book, but he kind of shows up in many different chapters because he was a central figure in many different bookstores and publishing houses in the early 20th century. So he writes this great novel about a couple. They're not initially a couple, but these two strangers, essentially, who find themselves manning they call it a van, but it was powered by a horse, this kind of mobile bookmobile that they take through the country to sell books. And it's a kind of romanticized, but still imperfect view of what book selling was like. And the book was so popular, it actually inspired a group of people, more than just a handful, but a decent number of Americans who said, well, I'm going to try and create my own Parnassus on Wheels. Some of them even use the same name. And so throughout the 1920s, especially up and down the East Coast, but to some degree even out west and out where you are in Utah, in Colorado and California, there were this kind of boom of mobile booksellers, which I think is just a kind of fascinating and wonderful, if not forgotten, chapter of American bookselling history.
And so it would basically go to a place that didn't have a bookshop or didn't have one within 100 miles. Would that be it?
Well, they would often try and find tourist destinations. So okay. It might be through national parks, or, you know, wealthy people would often go to resorts in the summer to kind of get away. And there weren't always permanent bookshops there. And one example, somebody in New York City, this guy named Frank Shea, who started a mobile bookmobile called Parnassus on Wheels. Basically, he said his customers, who were very affluent, would often disappear in the summer. And so he was just going to follow them to the kind of New England resorts. But it was very difficult to make money. Not that book selling is ever easy, but he had some quip about, you know, when people go to the beach, they don't bring any money with them. So they're not really in the mindset to buy a bunch of stuff. So there were some problems, and they were often shooed away because there was this notion that they were peddlers and that they were, you know, who knows where they got their material from. Maybe they were stealing things, and they seemed shady to many of the more sort of affluent residents of these kind of august communities and wealthy resorts.
Okay, you argue that the evolution of book sales toward the superstore begins with Marshall Fields and a woman named Marcella Honor. Who was she, and how did she change book retailing?
So Marcella Honor worked at a clerk in some Chicago bookstore, and one of the executives at Marshall Field, which was a very, you know, hoity-toity department store that catered to luxury consumers, was relatively late to incorporate a separate book department, which Macy's and some other big department stores had already done, in order to kind of even create an atmosphere catering to what they called the carriage trade, or really high-class group of consumers. And so one of the executives had just loved Marcella Honor as a bookseller at some local Chicago shop, and invited her to essentially build out the entire Marshall Field book department and to run it, which she did for the better part of the period between World War I and World War II. And she created not just one of the largest, if not the largest, bookstores in the United States, but one of the most influential, and also one in which the scale didn't really diminish its reputation. So unlike some of the corporate stores in the 1990s, there were very few people who said, you know, Marshall Field's was a sellout kind of place. And they very much focused on catering to individual customers. And for example, one of Honor's off-use techniques was, on days when it was raining, she and her sales clerks would call regular customers with book recommendations and offer to have them delivered that day by horse. So, you know, everybody thinks Amazon is so convenient, but, you know, back in the 1920s, you could get a book delivered in a couple hours by horse, and they didn't even charge a delivery fee.
Awesome. Now, who was Francis Steloff, and how did the Gotham Book Mart evolve?
Yeah, so she was also another amazing and one of the most influential booksellers of the 20th century, or even of all time. And she was a lover of the arts and had this idea of starting a kind of artsy bookstore, carrying initially a lot of out-of-print materials. And it developed into a bookstore that helped birth modernist literature as we know it, a lot of avant-garde writers and poets, essayists, novelists would flock to her to have their books carried there, which weren't necessarily mainstream and carried elsewhere. And a lot of these authors eventually became mainstream, and thanks to her, and she became this powerhouse influencer of literature. And her bookstore, like many others, was a community, but it had this very atypical customer base of lots of artists, people like, you know, Patti Smith in later years spent much time there, Anais Nin, and all sorts of, you know, had many supporters early on. And she became so famous that she herself was essentially synonymous with the store, and people would come to just see her and hang out with her. And I just learned, and this didn't make it into the book because I didn't know it, but somebody sent me an email and said that there's this song from The Band, and it's "Take a Load Off, Fanny." Mm-hmm. And apologies for my poor singing voice.
Sure.
But the person they're referring to was Frances Steloff, who went by Fanny.
No.
Wow.
Saying, take a load off, Fanny. So they had, the songwriter was into like European film, and you know, if you were into something niche like that or esoteric and you wanted to read about, you know, indie cinema, European film, the Gotham Bookmark was the one place you could find books about that kind of thing.
You know, so in the middle of the book, there's this amazing photograph of a bunch of authors at a Gotham function. I mean, the mm-hmm. range of substantial literary figures that were surrounded this place, everyone from, like, you know, W.H. Auden to Gore Vidal. I mean, it just looks like an amazing place. Would have been really fun to hang out there. That party looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, she hosted many great parties. She was at many great parties. She went to at least one of Warhol's factory parties later on, which I had a lot of fun imagining what that would have been like for her, because she was elderly by that point and wasn't herself very tapped into kind of pop culture at all. But the image you're referring to, you know, many literary scholars think was like one of the greatest congregations mm-hmm. of authors ever in history. And there's a great little story about someone who didn't think Gore Vidal was worthy of being in the image, and was trying to push him out, apparently unsuccessfully.
You devote a chapter to Nazi and communist bookstores. Can you share a little bit about what the Aryan bookstore was?
So I was really interested in activist bookstores, and I profile a couple, and many of them are sort of championing various causes that most of us would be sympathetic to. But I also thought it'd be interesting to profile the Aryan bookstore, which was espousing hate and discrimination and prejudice. But the kind of takeaway is much the same, that they, Nazis and civil rights leaders, realized the potential of the bookstore as a place to persuade, in this case, indoctrinate through literature. So this became popular in the Great Depression, and some Aryan bookstores, including the one in Los Angeles that I profile, operated completely above ground with, you know, glass windows opening onto the street, and it called itself the Aryan bookstore and promoted fascist literature and would encourage people to come in off the street. And during the Depression, of course, many people were in the midst of very hard times and would come in, and the booksellers would try to explain why life was so difficult, and their explanation was usually something along the lines of, you know, American democracy and Jews were to blame in some way. Hmm. And it was a really, you know, anchor of an American Nazism campaign in an attempt to bring Nazism to America.
Interesting. So much has been written about the demise of the brick-and-mortar bookstore. often attributed to Amazon. Yet Barnes & Noble is about to open a new store right here in Park City. How did Barnes & Noble survive while companies like Borders, et cetera, did not? Any idea?
So I think Barnes & Noble is opening 54 stores this year, more or less, which is amazing. Really amazing and surprising to many people. And, of course, Barnes & Noble's the number of stores had been in decline for many years, as had the total revenue. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Len Riggio, who was the person who essentially turned Barnes & Noble into a household name. And I asked him about, you know, the decline of book selling. And he had often been villainized as this kind of figure who crushed independent bookstores. And he had an interesting answer, which was basically like, the only entity we crushed was Borders, and that, you know, indies are still around today, and so is Barnes & Noble. And from talking to him and doing some of the research, it seemed that with the wave of Amazon, that the big corporate booksellers were very much bloodied, and Barnes & Noble suffered. And there was really just not enough room for both of them, and so they would often compete with one another. And when one would open in a retail shopping center, the other would open nearby to be competitive. But once the market shrank, it really wasn't viable. So it was really just a question of which one would survive, and it seemed unlikely that both would. And Barnes & Noble just seemed to have a kind of surer financial footing, a longer history. They had this partnership with Starbucks and the cafes, which had proven fruitful. So they seem to have edged out Borders and benefited very much from not having that competition anymore.
And what are they selling? You know, it's a very, you know, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about bookstores that are heavy on service and recommendations. Is a Barnes & Noble just selling access to large quantities of titles? Is that their market niche?
Well, they came to prominence by promising kind of a democratic vision of bookstores. That is, they wanted to be not a stuffy, elitist space. They wanted to be a place where anybody could feel comfortable coming in off the street and hang out for a long time without necessarily pressure to buy anything, hence the cafes and all the chairs and tables and such. So that was part of, always has been part of the brand. And in the 90s and early 2000s, the contrast between Barnes & Noble's and independent bookstores was much greater than I think it is today, as both Barnes & Noble's and the indies have become in many ways allies in the fight against Amazon and are trying to preserve the landscape of brick and mortar bookstores. And many of the new Barnes & Noble's, and I would guess this is true about the one coming to Park City, are much smaller than the superstores built in the 1990s. And James Daunt, the current CEO of Barnes & Noble's, who I also had the pleasure of talking to in my research, basically has said he wants the new Barnes & Noble's to look more like the independents around the country. Hmm. And he had his own history of creating an independent bookstore and a series of them back in London. So he's really trying to bring that same ethos here to the States.
Last question. We got about a minute left. What do you see as the future of the independent bookstore? I know that the number has shrunk, but do you think it's stabilized now? And do you think we'll always see stores like that in America?
Well, I wish I could look into the future better than anybody else. But I will say there's certainly been a stabilization, and we just talked about this mini resurgence within Barnes & Noble, and the long decline has certainly slowed. I'm not sure we're ever going to get back to the same number of bookstores, at least per capita, that we've had throughout much of the 20th century, but I think there's a lot to feel optimistic about. There are new stores opening, very different kinds of stores, and a whole lot of new kinds of voices that are being represented in bookselling that hadn't been present before. So it's not just about the number of stores, but I think there's a great kind of diversity of shops, and there's a lot to be optimistic about.
The book is The Bookshop, A History of the American Bookstore. We've been speaking with author Evan Friss. Evan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's been great to talk.
We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm sitting here with Adam and Misha Ross. You know them from Twisted Fern, and they've opened a new place called Roma. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Loma, I know Loma as the exit down off I-70 where you can go mountain biking in Colorado. So what is Loma here?
Loma is Lower Maine.
Ah.
Oh.
We got you.
Yes, you did.
Okay, that's all we needed to know. Thanks. No, so it's Italian, I understand.
Yes.
Can you give us a little more details about the style of Italian?
Style of Italian, it's modern Italian, and my take on that is a melting pot. So the brass tags of it is Italian, but then we're pulling a little bit of Spanish, we're pulling a bit of Moroccan, Greek, kind of the entire Mediterranean coastline.
Outstanding.
So give us some of the menu highlights so that we can get a little, let's dig in a little bit. What are the sort of top three or four entrees that are featured in the menu for dinner?
Let's see.
Well, let's start with sort of the menu layout. So the menu, yeah, so the menu and kind of the idea is a little bit different than a lot of traditional Italian, which I think is something that we've, you know, been working on kind of helping the visitor to understand Italian in America means so many different things, right? You have like, you know, a melting pot of different concepts. Loma is really more of a place where you come and you sit down and you really enjoy the evening. We're not trying kind of a restaurant term is to kind of turn and burn. We're really trying to get people in. There's a salad, there are salads, there are pizzas, there are pastas, and then there are entrees and desserts. And so it really is kind of the idea is to come and enjoy each of those a little bit more traditional in the style of dining that you see in Europe than we do here in American restaurants. So we think we're seeing people come and just really kind of share a pizza and then they'll order a pasta or an entree on their own and also share a couple of appetizers.
Gotcha. So the pizza would be the traditional side of it. Do you have lasagna also or linguine with white clam sauce?
We do not.
Sorry, less traditional. Yeah.
Yeah, so less traditional menu items. So there are, you know, for appetizers, there's a mussel dish that's, you know, really good. There's the pizzas are also non-Americanized. So there's, Adam can speak more to the specifics of the menu items, but it's all very much more based on, I think, European styles of dining.
Gotcha. So what would be the most popular pizza or the first pizza listed on the menu?
Most popular is probably the Italian meats.
Okay.
Which is made with a house-made Italian sausage, and then we're pulling a lot of cured meat salamis from Caputo's down in Salt Lake that import a lot of fabulous meats. And then we have a roasted mushroom and Romanesco pizza that is more of an olive oil-based with pecorino, roasted garlic.
Oh, yeah. I didn't have breakfast today. You're killing me, man. let's see. So it's Italian, and I don't expect there to be gluten-free options, but are there?
There are gluten-free options. We are working on a gluten-free pasta still. We have not finished that recipe yet, though. It's in the works.
It's not that easy to make a gluten-free pasta that tastes good.
It is not.
So the challenge to the laboratory, and I think some of our listeners would be appreciative that you're trying. So we talked about some of the pizzas. Talk about some of the salads, Misha.
Well, my favorite one that I've had so far is a stone fruit salad. So it's really tying in just what's fresh, and that's what's a little bit challenging to talk about the menu because the menu. Right now we're in a great time in Utah for fresh foods that are that are coming off the harvest, but the menu will change with kind of what's the freshest and most in season as we get into winter and fall. There's also a black kale salad that's really good. There's a Caesar option. There's, you know, what I love about the menu is there are probably 4 to 5, Adam can specify, selections on each category. So the menu is manageable to, you know, really kind of go in with a group of people and really get a nice sampling of most items.
Yes.
Is that how most people eat, kind of family style, like pass the plate back and forth or side plates?
We've been seeing a lot of that. We've been seeing a lot of a couple of salads or starters, a pizza to start, and then each person in the group would choose either a pasta or an entree or another pizza as their focal point of dining.
Interesting. So I mentioned the linguine with white clam sauce, and I saw your menu has cockles.
Yes.
What's the difference between a cockle and a clam? I thought it was...
They're pretty much the same. Cockles have a little bit better sustainability rate right now. So that is why I'm using cockles.
And that leads us to a request for the broader tour of the pastas. Give us a little sense of the samples of pastas that you would have.
So we have six pastas. They're all made in-house. We have amalfidine, which is lobster, local cherry tomatoes, in a lobster broth, corn, and malfadine is a pasta shape. It's like a skinny lasagna or fettuccine with frills. Mm-hmm. Delicious texture. Then we have a cavatelli, which is a hand-formed pasta. Mm-hmm. Think of like a elongated, what's the necklace that everybody wore in the 90s?
Puka shells?
Puka shells.
Yeah,
Puka
yeah,
shells.
Yeah.
Think of that, but just about like 2 inches long.
Amazing.
Interesting image. Not necessarily one that I think of as appetizing, but it's an interesting image.
We all got it.
A ricotta gnocchi.
Ooh.
That is going with a pulled pork and Italian sausage, red sauce with a house-made ricotta, house-made mozzarella. And then I'm drawing a blank because that's what I do. And let's see.
We should have brought some menus.
Yeah, really?
You didn't know you were going to get a quiz. This is kind of like a pop quiz, but I'm not done asking pop quiz questions. So now I'm going to ask you about entrees.
Entrees, we have a chicken milanese. It's a pounded chicken breast and chicken thigh. Poulet Rouge, it's a heritage bird out of North Carolina that we're using. It's a smaller bird. It's about portions like 8 ounces, but it's pounded out large, so it looks like it's the size of your face. Going with a nice arugula salad, feta, pickled onions, and then we have a larger Nyman Ranch ribeye, going with like polenta croutons, a nice balsamic, basil butter. That's kind of your big steak if somebody wants a steak. Then we have a Golden Eagle sable fish, which is black cod.
Yeah.
It's a boutique farm out of British Columbia producing some really awesome, sustainable black cod. Those are...
And these sound like dinner options. Do you have a lunch menu? Are you open for lunch?
We do brunch on Saturday and Sunday, 10:30 to 2:30. And it's a limited pizza, pasta, starter section that's similar to the dinner menu, and then we have a full-on like brunch entree side. Italian eggs, which is similar to a shishushka, egg stewed in like a red sauce. We have some breakfast sandwiches. We have a roasted lamb gyro.
Pancakes.
And so brunch is just Saturday and Sunday, you said?
Yes.
Okay. And it's so if people come travel here for Thanksgiving or Christmas, they can pop by if they don't get in for dinner?
Possibly.
No,
brunch is looking...
Thanksgiving's on a Thursday, so we won't have brunch then.
Most years.
I think the brunch is likely going to end at the end of September, though.
Okay.
Yes. So you would want to get in sooner than that.
Yes.
So you want brunch, yeah. Get there quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll probably stop brunch for the off-season.
You know, many people's understanding of restaurants is limited to looking at the menu and asking what's for dinner. Talk a little bit about the process of getting a place like Loma ready for a service. When does it start? What are the kind of some of the steps? And what do you do to keep busy? Because I imagine this is an extraordinarily busy thing for you guys to do.
Yeah. So to start, starting tonight's service actually started yesterday to start the starters for the pizza dough, the focaccia. All of that starts the day before, creating the poulish. And then pastas are made early on in the morning, about right now. And those are the two big time-consuming, the things that we cannot forget to do every night, every morning, because it'll be a very hard next day if we do.
Okay, and then what happens next? When does the shift come in? A lot of us, to the extent any of us have familiarity to how to run a restaurant, it probably comes from the bear. I suspect it's not quite like that. But, you know, still the process of, you know, preparing. Just can you give us a little more sense of what life is like in that kitchen starting at like 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon?
Well, Loma opens at 4.
Right.
So by 4 o'clock.
Like 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah, so yes. By 4 o'clock, everything is kind of already ready.
Yeah.
Most of the shift comes at, you know, like Adam said, there's a prep cook that's there now, and they're working on the pastas and getting everything ready so that when the line comes in the afternoon, it's as close as possible, and they just need to set their station. Typically the line comes in between, so that's the line cooks, they come in between 2 and 3? Mm-hmm.
2 and 3, and they're responsible for finishing a lot of the things, doing all the very end prep. So you're mincing garlic, you're cutting up herbs, chopping herbs, you're just doing all the quick stuff that can't last, that's all kind of a la minute. Uh-huh. And the shelf life on it is limited.
So what are the different roles each of you have? I mean, it sounds like you're in the kitchen, Adam, and Misha, you run the entire show.
No, I don't. So Adam runs the show.
Nice.
I have a marketing and PR background, so I do a lot of marketing here in Park City, and so I help more just on the business side. I spend very little time in the actual restaurant. We have two little kids, so I spend a lot of time playing mom and doing all of those things, and then helping my clients that I work with. And so I kind of look at both Twisted Fern and Loma as a client. I kind of nag Adam about this and that, and make sure that we do things like this, and try and become as prepared as possible, so that the main thing that I found in marketing is just consistency in messaging is really important. And so if we can kind of continue to promote what the foundation of the restaurant is, it makes it a little bit easier than promoting like the, you know, kind of the idea of the day type of thing. So we just try and be really consistent in our messaging and try and grow the business that way.
One of the challenges when we talk to restaurateurs in this town is staffing. And did you have an advantage by having Twisted Fern? Were you able to bring some employees over? And what have you seen in terms of the challenges of finding staff?
I've been able to bring staff over from Fern, and it's been great to kind of set the ethos at Loma. I can't bring all of my staff over, but it definitely helps placing certain people in certain roles to kind of help create a similar vibe that we've been able to create over the past 7 years at Twisted Fern. I have some great managers. I have a great chef that's helping me out now, who's been with me for about 2 years. And we're slowly just building the teams over at Loma.
The other thing that I think Adam has a really good reputation of being a good employer, and I think that's really important. You know, Adam is there day in and day out, kind of in the trenches, and I think that makes a big difference for employees when it's not we're not managing down. He's really like in the trenches.
Outstanding. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Adam and Misha Ross of Loma, and now we all know what Loma means, Lower Main. Adam and Misha, thank you very much for being here. We'll be right back.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. This morning, we are joined in studio by Gord Boyce of Mayflower Mountain Consulting. Good morning, Boyd. Gord, I'm combining them both.
Good morning, Kevin. No problem.
So, Mayflower Mountain Consulting, I understand we're going to step into something called EOS, but can you give us a brief description of your background?
Sure. So, originally, I'm from Canada. I've been traveling around through different work destinations, but I've been into... with a company called Nokia, which many people have heard of in Chicago. They moved me down to Dallas and where I worked there for about 8 years and ended up running a pretty sizable business for them. Left there and went to a high-tech startup as VP of Sales and Marketing and ultimately became CEO of that company. I took it from $6 million a year to $120 million a year. It went public a couple of years later and then ultimately got bought by a private equity firm. So I did something right. And a few years ago, my wife and I decided that we were tired of living in California, and so we wanted a change, and I decided to make a change as well. Using my experience, I decided to start a company to implement the entrepreneurial operating system, which I've been doing here in Park City for about 18 months.
Okay, so EOS, what is it?
Well, EOS, as I mentioned, stands for the Entrepreneurial Operating System. It's a complete but simple set of tools which help entrepreneurial companies run more effectively. It's all about clarifying vision, creating accountability and execution throughout your organization, which will lead to long-term health. Mm-hmm. And we do that by really focusing on what we call the six key components of your business. And those six key components are vision, clarifying what your vision is, where you're planning on going, and how you're planning on getting there, and making sure that your entire management team understands that and agrees with it. People is all about having the right people in the right seats with you. The third key component is the data component. That's all about getting entrepreneurial organizations out of this idea of running their company based on gut feel or intuition and into running it on sort of 9 or 10 or 13 basic metrics that you can keep a pulse on your business every week. The issues component is just really about creating a culture where people are not afraid to put up their hand and say, I've got an issue. But secondly, also we give our clients a couple of tools, one that helps them compartmentalize their issues so they're talking about them at the right time. And when they're going to talk about a specific issue, we give them a tool called the IDS tool, which is Identify, Discuss, and Solve, which I won't go into today, but it's just a very effective way of working through issues. Most companies talk around and around and around. This really gets you to the core of it quickly.
Gotcha. So where and how did EOS originate?
Did we miss two issues? We just missed
two key components, really.
Go ahead, please.
But no. Do you want me to continue on?
No, continue on.
The last one's very, very important. The process component is also incredibly important, but every great company, like McDonald's, they make a Big Mac the same way in Madrid as it's made in Miami. And every company has something like that. We want to uncover what those four or five things are. Make sure that everyone understands them very well and that they're locked away in a safe someplace. And then lastly, traction is about taking that vision and bringing it down to the ground and giving it traction by harmonizing the rest of the key components, but also doing things like giving every individual in your company something called a ROC, which is nothing more than a 90-day business objective, as well as a meeting pulse, which is a prescription for when you're holding your meetings, which is at the same time, on the same day, every week with the same agenda. It just makes everything run more effectively.
And are you hired by the company to do those steps?
So I am a professional EOS implementer, which means that this is what I do as my full-time job. I help my clients work through the EOS methodology.
Can you give us a case study without a name? Just give us a sense of the process that you will go through with a typical client.
Right. So we have EOS as a proven process, and we work with our clients to come up with whatever their proven process is, whatever, like McDonald's, a good example would be how they make a Big Mac. Our proven process is how we take our clients through the EOS process, which starts with what we call a 90-minute meeting, which is just nothing more than a 90-minute meeting where we do a deep dive on the EOS methodology and how we go through the process, basically an extended version of what we're doing today. Then we move into what we call session days. The first one is called a focus day, 7 hours plus or minus an hour, where we work through all the traction tools. 30 days later, we go into vision building 1 and 2, which are 2 days where we really clarify that vision. Once that is done, we move into execution mode where I come in and I work with my clients on a quarterly basis to have a look at where they've been over the last 90 days. Did they meet their ROCs or their 90-day business objectives or not? And if they didn't, what were the problems? We'll talk about the issues involved in that. And then we'll set up another 90-day plan moving forward. And we'll meet again in 90 days to see how they did. once a year, we'll get together for an annual session where we'll set up a strategy for the next year and just make sure that all the vision work that we've done in the past is still relevant.
Well, interesting. It's, so if someone is has a company that's, you know, doing well, but they feel it could do better, they would give you a shout and you'd give them a couple of rocks and...
Presumably, we would work through the EOS process, and by doing so over time, it'll increase their operational efficiency. And every client that comes to myself and others in the community, typically they come to us for something. Growth has been stagnated or have a people problem, whatever it is, and that ends up migrating into something else as we uncover and we add clarity to their organization.
So what kind of training did you have to go through in order to learn to be an EOS implementer?
So just specifically to be an EOS implementer, I went through an extensive training program as well as quarterly sessions with the EOS team to make sure that I'm current. And there's various certifications that we all have and training that we need to keep up on. But I think the being an expert at EOS is one thing, but also my background as being I've been a CEO a couple of times and, shepherded one company to going public. So right.
That's the complete realm, right?
Right. So my clients, they get a proven process in EOS. It's a framework for running an entrepreneurial business. If you've got 10 employees to 250 employees, you should be doing everything that's in this program. I will help and guide my clients through that program with my 30 years of experience as a leader.
And how long will an engagement typically last?
So I ask my clients to have it in their mind that this is a two-year journey. Typically, it takes our clients about 2 years to get EOS fully implemented. Some clients stop early. Some keep moving forward with their implementer for as long as they see fit. They love the facilitation that the implementer brings to them, and that in many cases, like my clients enjoy my background as well. So it really depends.
I love it. I'm gonna go back to the previous part. So where did EOS originate? How did it originate?
So it was founded by a gentleman by the name of Gino Wickman about 20 years ago. He was an entrepreneur at a very young age. He turned his parents' company around and sold it to a private equity firm, and through that process, realized that he was pretty good at running entrepreneurial-like companies. And so he began cobbling together what became EOS as a methodology, and then he wrote a book called Traction, which is Gaining Traction, which has been around for about 15 years, and that is the kind of the EOS Bible, if you will, for how EOS, the EOS methodology and how it's implemented.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the reasons, the specific reasons that you see that companies come to you. You know, what are the kinds of problems they're experiencing that really drive the need for some EOS help?
Really, one of the first things we do in the EOS process is go through an exercise called hitting the ceiling. And that's generally what defines what many of our clients are coming to us for. It takes on many different forms, as I mentioned earlier. Their growth is stagnating. They're having trouble with the people component within their organization, or they're just disorganized for whatever reason. Usually, clients come to us for one reason, and it as I mentioned, it migrates to something else.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, often when you have a job like yours and you'll walk into a new company, sometimes you're going to see things immediately that the people who are too close to it can see. Can you give me some examples of where you've walked in and said, okay, they're not doing this, and it's not that hard?
Sure. So one of my clients came to me early on and told me that the reason that they hired me was because they were not satisfied with the level of sales, the revenue growth. And we had worked together previously together at Nokia, and he said, if anyone knows anything about sales, it's you, Gord. So that's why I'm hiring you. So I came in to implement EOS with them, and we discovered very quickly that really what they needed was better organization, and that's really what we did. When we went through the vision building, the two session days for vision building, it really clarified where they wanted to be, and we adjusted their sales targets. We actually adjusted them up, and now we have an achievable plan to do that.
So is that the main reason people call you, because profits need to...
That's one reason. It could be a myriad of different reasons. As I mentioned, it's sales that has stagnated, it's not growing, it's maybe shrinking. They're having trouble with organizational problems. They just need to get a handle on, you know, where they are is really a lot of the reasons why people are coming to us.
How often do you see, in an entrepreneurial environment, you start out with, obviously you have a founder and a visionary. As you start to grow, complexities tend to emerge regarding leadership. How often do you see leadership problems as a reason for them coming to see you, and how do you address those?
Well, so the that is one of the exercises that we go through in one of the very first sessions, as we talk about their organizational chart, and we design their perfect organization for where they want to be in 12 months, not where they are today, where they're going to be in 12 months. And oftentimes, and we do that without people in mind. We do that with what are the roles and responsibilities that this organization needs in the next 12 months to be successful. Once we've done that, then we'll start slotting in names. Mm-hmm. And we go through a bunch of exercises where we will compare whether or not we have the right people based on some of the exercises that we've done in your vision building to fill those right seats. And often, members of the management team will not fit into that that organizational chart. And we recommend
that can be difficult.
It can be difficult, but that is a truth that we try and point out, and it's up to the management team to decide what to do with that information.
Hmm. Ouch. So, how can people learn more about your program, and how can people get a hold of you?
So you can go to my website, which is www.eosworldwide.com/gord/Boyce. That is my website. It's probably the best way to get a hold of me. That's where you can get more information on my company, Mayflower Mountain Partners, as well as how to get a hold of me.
Okay, and is your company, are you a one-man show? Is this something you do alone, or do you have associates you work with?
So this is a one-man show. I'm a solopreneur.
Okay. We've been talking to Gord. Why can't we get your name right, Gord?
It is so embarrassing. I am Canadian.
And so we've been talking to Gord Boyce of Mayflower Consulting. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.